Welcome to the Gambling Files RTFM, the deeper dive, the longer episode, the more talking, as we like to call it. I'm John Bruford. I'm one of your esteemed hosts. We're joined by my excellent co-host, Fintan Costello, who has lost that loving feeling. Fintan.
Yeah, and I'm probably less esteemed than John. So, yeah, great to be here.
Sucks to be you, dude.
It does. It does. It's a hard life.
And let's be fair, anybody that is less esteemed than me is having a bad, bad, bad day. But we are joined by somebody who is far more esteemed than either of us because she is a partner in law firm Northridge Law, considered something of a don, not in the academic term, in the mafia sense. Melanie Ellis of Northridge Law fame. Melanie, welcome.
Thank you. I'm not in the mafia, I promise.
No, it's a mafia-like grip that you have the department.
Very similar, yes. That's true.
I've looked on, is it glassceiling.com?
Glassdoor. Yeah.
that one, Glassdoor. And it's like, loved my time at Northridge Law. Mel ruled me with a rod of iron.
Yeah, so that's probably fair.
I think that's what it said. I forget the details. Mel, why are we here today? We are going to discuss something truly fascinating.
We are going to talk about the recent license surrender by BGO Entertainment, who were going to undergo a license review from the Gambling Commission. The commission decided they would suspend their license during the review process, and BGO decided to hand their license in.
Crikey. Surrender sounds really kind of, I wouldn't say really dramatic, but in an anticlimactic kind of way. So it's kind of dramatic, but not.
Yeah, I mean, it's
like they didn't fight for it.
Yeah, it's actually not that uncommon. I was having a look at the numbers, and around 100 licensees have surrendered their license so far this year. But this is maybe one of the more high-profile ones.
Is it like, so did the Gambling Commission like surround their offices with bullhorns and be like, surrender your license, walk out with your hands up. And somebody like throws the license on the ground and they all walk out with their heads low and their hands in the air. Is that a license surrender?
Yeah, I think it's a little bit less dramatic. It's actually a bit of a quiet surrender by sending a little email to your account manager saying that you don't want to operate anymore and you will definitely give everybody's money back.
That's a little bit disappointing, I've got to be honest.
Yeah, it's quite anticlimactic when it has to happen.
Huh. Well, but joking aside, I mean, it's obviously this is going to have a serious impact for anybody employed by BGO, and that sucks.
Yeah, that's a real shame.
Fintan, do you have any idea how many people they had working in the UK? Do you know?
I've no clue. I've always been a big fan. I think when they launched the marketing that they did, like they used celebrity endorsements in a really good, I think they had Paris Hilton and I can never remember the guy's name. The mini me guy from the Austin Powers.
Vern Troyer, is that?
Yes, that's it.
Vern Troyer.
And that's it, but yeah.
So John probably knows him.
well, we go to the same tailor.
So they've a lot of they really built upon, like, I think when you look at this, say the UK bingo market, you know, you had Foxy Bingo and you had some brands who kind of did some really good branding, and then Vigo kind of came in and went much further. And did it in a much kind of bigger, more international way, which I was always a fan of. So Mike, and I'm just looking at LinkedIn now. So according to LinkedIn, there's over 30 staff in the UK, okay. Give or take. So more actually, 30, yeah, nearly 50 staff in the UK, according to LinkedIn. So that's a big deal. Yeah. And it's a real shame because most of them are, you know, they'd have done nothing wrong or, it's just one of those things. But my question is, obviously, Bigo is the recent example, and I don't really want to I wouldn't want to focus too much on them because none of us know the details. But the UK as a market historically has been the, you know, it's been the kind of the flagship licensing market. So having a UK license was one of the most prestigious things you could do before other countries kind of caught up and started issuing licenses. How hard or easy is it to get a UK license compared to, say, if I wanted to go get a Malta license or
One of those tasty Curacao licenses?
that's just the check cleared. But let's take Malta as an example. Is it difficult to get a UK license? Is it stringent? Is it relatively straightforward?
It's quite a time consuming process in terms of the documents and information you have to pull together. It's not dissimilar from Malta in that respect, and I think Malta have become a more stringent regulator recently. But it's, you know, there's not any real barrier to getting a UK license as long as you can pull together the information that you need to. So if you can demonstrate the legitimate source of funding of the business and you can draft appropriate policies and procedures which convince the Gambling Commission that you're going to be compliant, particularly from the responsible gambling and AML perspective, then they're obliged to license people for gambling as long as there's not a risk to the licensing objectives. It's not an easy process in that it takes a long time to pull the information together, and it then takes a long time for the Gambling Commission to determine the application. But there's no particular reason people should be refused a license.
So let's imagine I find a friendly oligarch who's made his billions in somewhere, I don't know, wherever, and he wants to open up a casino because it's a cool, sexy thing to do. So obviously, the policies and procedures, I'm guessing, are pretty off-the-shelf kind of templates. You can find somebody who can give you all the documents you need.
Yeah, you can find somebody like me who would be happy to help you draft those policies and procedures based on a template, but they do need to be tailored to, you know, what everybody's doing. But
of course. Yeah,
that's quite straightforward. The management of the operator obviously need to know and understand those policies and why they say what they say. So you can't just put in some document that you've never even read. Sometimes the commission will do a telephone interview with a PML applicant, for example, to make sure that they do understand. But yeah, the more difficult part of it sometimes can be providing enough evidence on the source of funding. And if you have a Russian oligarch, there may be aspects of how they've made their money that isn't completely clear and easy to demonstrate with documents.
So I couldn't just point at my gas well or my, you know, steel factory and just say it came from there. You'd have to. Okay.
Maybe. It always depends on the circumstances, but the commission can want to go quite far in terms of tracing the origin of the money. So, you know, for example, somebody earned their money as a salary from a company, the commission will want to know who that company is and what they do, make sure they're a legitimate business. They may even want to know who the customers of that company are to make sure that they're legitimate. It could go on forever, but eventually somebody has to take a view. Depending on the complexity of the funding, that can be a bigger or a smaller part of the application.
Got it. And then I suppose if we kind of work through the process, then the, you know, you're probably going to approach some sort of software suppliers or I presume there's licensing then for the software as well?
Yes. Yeah, so if you've developed your own software, you have to get a software license as well as your operating license, or you can choose to get your software from a third party, but they then need to be in turn licensed by the commission. You might decide to use a platform provider and simply sort of be providing the front end of the gambling service. And again, they need to be licensed as a B2B provider.
So if you went to like a Playtech or one of these kind of all-in-one, that you put your own interface and your own touch on top.
Yeah, exactly.
Is there anything else then you'd need to do to get a license?
Well, if it's your own software, you need to get it tested, certified by a test house if it's casino software. If it's just betting, you can test it internally. Trying to think now. Once you've got your software and your platform lined up and tested as needed and you've got your license, you need to obviously sort out bank accounts and payment processing. That can be a tricky stage, because some banks will be reluctant to deal with you until you're licensed, but then equally you want to get these things lined up before you get your license in place so you're ready to go. So that can be a bit of a hurdle. I think that's probably the main thing. So you'll also want to make sure you've got your customer terms and conditions drafted properly and in place. That's part of the license application as well.
Got it. And how long would that take? Like from kind of, you know, the drunken dinner where this comes up as a great idea to actually getting a license in your hand. How long does that take?
It could take about a year. Oh, wow. To be honest, because you need to put together a business plan. You might need to raise some money, but making sure all your terms and your policies are drafted correctly and you've gathered all that source of funding information can take a bit of time. You then get your license application into the commission. They used to say they'd determine it in 16 weeks, but that's gone out the window recently. It's more likely to be 6 months before they're able to determine it. It could be even longer if there's complex elements to it, like the source of funding is complex, or maybe it's a novel product that you want to offer, not just a standard betting or slots product.
Sure. And the 16 weeks gone out the window, is that because there's lots of applicants or the Gambling Commission short-staffed, or do you know what's behind that?
I mean, I think it first got extended during lockdown when they were working from home and people were off sick. And it got more difficult for them to go through their processes, but it's, things haven't gone back to the way they were. And I think, partly it's a lack of resources at the commission. They just don't have enough people processing the applications. I don't think there's particularly more applications than they used to be, but they are analyzing them in more depth than they used to. So spending more time looking at the policy, spending more time looking at the source of funding.
Got it. Look, I could imagine with the looming Gambling Act review and all these kind of things, anybody thinking about getting a gambling license in the UK is kind of like, well, let's give it a couple of months. Would that be a fair?
Not necessarily. I think, if you've got an idea for a new gambling business and you want to pursue it, I think you would still go ahead and apply for the license. I don't think the Gambling Act review is going to fundamentally change the fact that you need a license from the Gambling Commission if you want to operate in the UK. And I equally don't think it's going to make it a market that nobody wants to operate in. So no, I wouldn't necessarily think people would wait before applying.
Okay, that's interesting because I've seen it in other markets where Sweden and stuff, where people are just like, it's actually not worth it anymore to even operate.
Well, Sweden. Sweden.
My favorite country.
How that's changing.
Go ahead, man.
I was going to say, I'm sort of optimistic that the government have a balance in mind when they're reviewing the Gambling Act, and they have said that they understand that yes, we need to protect people who have a gambling problem, but equally we need to protect the interests of people who want to be free to pursue a legitimate leisure pursuit. So maybe I'm being overly optimistic, but I don't think it's going to suddenly make the UK market completely impossible to operate in.
Yeah.
But there's certainly never been any other instances of the UK government proving to be crushingly disappointing in anything they've been involved with.
Tell us what you really think, John.
And I think it's fair. Anybody that described the Gambling Act as being already out of date when it was enacted is a fool and a communist.
Okay.
I remember I went up to Asper's in Newcastle, and it had only been open about 6 months or something, and it was part of this, I mean, well, it still is part of this beautiful sort of leisure development. And Newcastle's just an absolutely banging town. It's just a great night out. And they built this lovely casino, and it's really well thought out. And certainly back then, the kitchen was spectacularly good.
Yeah.
But so I'm up and I'm having a really nice look around, and they got, I think it was Pokertech poker machines in there. So it's basically a way for a casino to provide poker all the time without losing any money on it, because of course it's peer to peer, and you know, you don't have to. You can do automated rake and blah, blah, blah. And it's just a far more cost-effective way to do it. But under the Gambling Act, they got these machines in. And under the Gambling Act, each seat at the machine was counted as a slot machine.
Yeah.
And you're like, wow, well, the Gambling Act's only just come in. And we're already finding technological reasons why it's out of date. That was just like, wow, well, it's surely only uphill from here. Things can only get better now. And here we are, awaiting this very, very exciting review.
Yeah, I don't know whether they're actually going to get around to thinking about the nitty-gritty, like issues about what counts as a slot machine, or even poker generally, because it seems a bit crazy to me that in order to just have a poker club, you need to have a full casino license, of which there's only a limited number. Whether they'll get on to thinking about those issues, I'm not sure.
Well, I mean, presumably things like that have an eye on AML, et cetera. But, you know, if somebody were going to launder money through a poker room, it would be a really, really slow way to launder money. So I'm sure there are quicker ways to do it. You know, I can think of at least five off the top of my head that don't involve a casino.
Well, you could do it on a poker. You could, if you had hide-seek poker and you're chip dumping among the players, you could move money around quite quickly.
Well, people in the room would have to be up to date with it, wouldn't they? I mean, it would have to be a fraudulent.
Oh, it'd be super obvious to anybody watching.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. But yeah. You know, if you're running a room that is an actual poker room, that it's just not going to happen.
Mm.
You'd pay extra to be on the chip dumping table because it'd be plus EV, right?
Gotcha. It would be the it would be the me arriving in a poker room online, basically.
They're all just following you around.
Lads, I've got too much money today. Have some. we did touch on Sweden because the law is changing there, or the sort of the trial set of stringent, some might say draconian, not me, regulations that they've had in place have relaxed. Fintan, I know you love Sweden in many ways. What are your thoughts on what's happened there?
Well, at the start of the lockdown, the original lockdown back in last year, they brought in a bunch of restrictions to protect players. So there was deposit limits, there was bonus limits.
We're not on video though, so I couldn't see you doing air quotes when you said protect.
No, I'm also counting off my fingers. So they brought in a bunch of protection, but what it actually did was, you can go look at Google Trends and see this. Created a huge shift in people searching for casinos without Swedish license or casinos without Spelpaws, which is their centralized opt-out program. So there's a massive shift to offshore casinos by Swedish players. And that trend's continued and accelerated. And from what I understand, anybody accepting offshore Swedish players is doing incredibly well right now. And the onshore guys. So the sad part is the operators who are playing by the rules are, they've lost a very key market. Lots of people have stopped the Swedish license process, and I think a lot of people have surrendered Swedish licenses as well.
You said the licensed operators are getting dicked.
They are, and not in a good way. There was an announcement last week saying that they were going to change they were going to lift the deposit limits, which was welcomed. But my understanding is that it's only the deposit limits and it doesn't affect the bonus restrictions.
The bonus restrictions are surely the main driver in people looking offshore.
You'd kind of, they kind of go hand in hand, but you're still, even if you change the bonus restrictions, but you still had a deposit limit, you've already, you've created a cap on the bonus that you can do any. So it, they kind of go hand in hand. I don't see them as independent. So if you look at, so from a Swedish player's perspective, even with the bonus, the deposit limits restrictions being lifted, and it's going to happen in the middle of November, I believe, it's still massively advantageous to look at offshore brands. You'll get far better value for money than you will with a licensed Swedish casino. So it's, I think it's, you know, it's the politicians sort of admitting that they've made a mistake, but without it having to admit they've made a mistake. And hopefully it's kind of the first step. If the world doesn't end when they do this, that in a few months' time after this, they'll change the deposits as well. Change the bonus restrictions as well. And I think that will effectively save the Swedish market. If they don't do it and this drags on for another year, I think the legal Swedish market will be effectively dead.
You'll see people throwing their licenses out into the street and coming out with their hands up. They'll just be surrendering them left and right.
This is the thing. If there's no punishment for taking Swedish players without a Swedish license, and if there's no downside to that, then why would you play by the rules?
That brings me to a question for Mel about the BGO thing. Yeah. Not specifically about BGO necessarily, but Mel, with a license surrender, could it possibly happen that the Gambling Commission would say to them, lads, you might want to surrender your license because otherwise we're going to do this, this, and this? Could it be suggested to somebody that they surrender their license, or is it solely a voluntary act?
No, not that I'm aware of. The Gambling Commission wouldn't suggest that somebody surrender their license, but I think, you know, they probably had legal advice as to the likely consequences, and it wasn't very optimistic.
If we look at this in the context of what we were talking about with Roz and Sharon last week, Fintan, and the punishment, we've got to switch to video because I need to do more air quotes, the punishment handed out to Crown for the Melbourne thing. You know, your punishment for not being fit to run your casino is that you run your casino ongoing, but somebody's going to have to look over your shoulder. Oh, okay. I was wondering if the commission had been able to bring any weight onto this to say to these people, you know, you can bow out gracefully or we can nail you to the wall kind of thing. And it be an example of a regulator saying you broke the rules, unlucky. I think we're seeing too many instances of, you know, nobody wants over-regulation, but regulation is a positive in an awful lot of ways. For the players particularly, and to see regulators in the Australia instance basically holding their hands up saying, yeah, it's fine, you crack on. Rather than, you know, you're not fit to have this license. There you go. There's your license back. I don't think it's just another bullet that we're giving to critics of the industry. It's another thing where we're saying, do you know what? Yeah, you're right. We can't look after ourselves. We can't do this. We need tighter regulations. If the watchdogs are ultimately toothless.
Yeah, I mean, by suspending their license while it carried out the review, the commission was, I think, quite clearly indicating this was a very serious matter.
Yeah,
which, you know, probably made it fairly clear that they were looking at, if not license revocation, then a very hefty fine. By suspending the license, the commission is showing that it does have teeth and it will take action if people aren't following the rules. And, you know, I think particularly in BGO's case, because they had their license reviewed last year, the commission's sort of saying, look, if we've looked at you already, you've promised to do better and you haven't quite followed through on that, then we will take it very seriously next time.
Was the suspension, is it a fixed period when that happens, or is it for the duration of investigation?
Yes, for the duration of the investigation. So, you know, these things can take a year. So realistically,
at the moment, it could have taken three.
Yeah. So realistically, if your license is suspended all that time and you're not able to do business, then you know, you're effectively out of the market anyway, really. So
what would happen to staff in that sort of circumstance then? If they've got 50 odd staff and they've got a suspension, that's...
Yeah, I mean, that's probably... That probably would have led to them losing their jobs anyway. So,
but they've got, obviously with the Alderney license, but I mean, there's probably only about 30 players on Alderney.
I don't know. They may have the Alderney license to do with relationships with maybe B2B operators based in Alderney. I'm not sure. I'm sure they have reasons for keeping that one.
It'd be for your outside of the UK business, though, right? It'd be like having a Malta license to operate.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm guessing.
So it wouldn't relate to the UK business.
But is an Alderney license, you know, like obviously the Malta license is pretty decent to have for most European jurisdictions. Is Alderney comparable?
Well, I mean, so you need to have a license now in almost every jurisdiction in Europe where you want to do business. People tend to keep things like the Malta license or the Alderney license because they need to have their main servers somewhere, so they need to be licensed there. They want to choose somewhere with good infrastructure and tax rates and so on. I think Malta is perhaps more appealing because it's in the EU. That opens the door to obtaining a license in some other EU jurisdictions that require you to be an EU company or have your servers in the EU. So Alderney has become less appealing for the European market for that reason. But yeah, there are still quite a few licensed there, and some of the B2B operators keep their servers in Guernsey still.
But Alderney is, of course, very close to some significant bird sanctuaries.
And perhaps that's why people like to be licensed there as well.
It's possible. Maybe there are some twitches on the BGO staff. I don't know.
I was devastated last year, but my sister was actually getting married. She had her wedding planned in Curacao.
Hang on, you were devastated that your sister was getting married? Fenton, is this something
you
want to
be doing? No, he's a lovely guy. But they were going to do it in Curacao. So I was going to go to I had it all planned out. I was going to go to the technology park. So you know that there's that Curacao address that gets used for all the licenses. So I was going to go get some photos taken with me in Curacao with like the street sign or something for the... whatever the building is that everyone's got their license in. Had it all planned out, and then obviously the wedding got cancelled. So
you could have done it while drinking Curacao for just to make it even more topical.
Wow, deep meta, which is the neutral word this week. So let's go back to my hypothetical. No, was it
hypothetical?
Hypothetical. This is why we bring on experts. So I've got my oligarch. We've got our license. We've got our casino. We're all guns blazing. He's a guy who's not used to hearing the word no. Mm. How hard do I have to work to keep my license? So, like, how often would I get knocks on the door saying, "Hey, we want to check your books. We want to see what's going on. Are you behaving yourself?" How does that kind of process work?
Yeah. So the commission does regular compliance assessments with all operators, but it's got limited resources. So it does operate on a sort of risk assessed basis. So the bigger the operator gets, the more impact they will have on UK consumers, the more attention the commission will pay to them. But I think all operators can expect to have some sort of knock on the door every 2 to 3 years. As a minimum. So certainly, yeah, within the first 2 to 3 years of operating, you can expect perhaps a desktop compliance assessment where the commission will, they do them online now, go through some of your customer records and check that you're doing appropriate AML and responsible gambling checks. So, yeah, I mean, I don't think anyone's going to be able to hold their license long term if they are allowing people to play with large amounts of money without doing the appropriate checks.
Got it. Okay, so you know you could get away with it for a couple of years, but you're going to get caught pretty quickly.
You might get away with it for a couple of years if you're lucky.
Yeah. Okay. And then, like, what's the warning procedures? Like, so, okay, let's say they come in after, say, 6 to 12 months. There's enough business to actually see what's going on. They can see some red flags in terms of AML or responsible gambling or the usual stuff. Like, is it a, hey, you've got a couple of weeks to sort this out, or stop business immediately, or if this is a warning, we'll be back in 6 months? Yeah. How does that work?
I mean, it depends how serious it is, what they find. If they found there were, you know, large numbers of customers spending six-figure sums, you hadn't done anything, they'd probably suspend your license straight away. But if it's more of a usual, they'll have a look, and maybe there's a few customers who've, you know, maybe they spent sort of 10 grand in a couple of months or something like that, they will go through a process with you. And they have a new process they call special measures, where they find some things aren't quite right, and they give you a chance to kind of, you know, amend your policies and procedures and have an action plan that you're going to follow to improve things. And then they'll come in and do another compliance assessment and hopefully see that things are a lot better. So in short, they do give you a chance to improve if they find things aren't great, and then they'll come back again a while later, and if things still aren't great, then they'll move on to the next level, the full investigation, the license review, and so on.
Got it.
I think that they could make the whole process more entertaining by employing Ray Winston, who obviously famously he fronted the adverts for, I think it was Bet365 for the in-play betting and stuff. And he's, you know, but imagine if, instead of getting a stern letter or email or some bureaucrat visiting you and saying, excuse me, I think you'll find you can't. Imagine if it were Ray Winston who just phoned you up and said, shut it, Dan.
Do you want Ray Winston or do you want Danny Dyer?
Oh.
What about both of them show up at your door?
Ooh, yeah, and Ray starts with, shut it, Dan. And Danny's like, you slag.
It could be a new approach for the Gambling Commission.
And we give them GoPros and we just let them, and we live stream the whole thing. So it'd be like some sort of YouTube thing. This could be great.
I think we'd just revolutionize the gambling industry, Fintan. Just in one swell foop.
And obviously, like, I think just to, I know we've said Beagle a lot, but looking through the Gambling Commission website, like, tons of fines have been handed out to lots of brands, like, you know, Flutter. I'm just looking through there's lots of names here, big names, big money, big fines, GameSys, Platinum, Ladbrokes, Coral, like, 6 million. So it's not picking on one brand. There's a wider issue here, I think, in the industry. But it sounds like, from what you're saying, Mel, and I'm guessing you've been at the coalface with a lot of this as well, it does seem like there's a process for it. The Gambling Commission does try and work with you. And if you're playing by the rules, it's not some sort of arbitrary thing. It's not like, say, so let's pick Sweden again, where the rules in Sweden are really vague and you only find out you've broken the rules in court. Mm. It sounds like in the UK, it's more structured and it's fairer and better organized.
To an extent, and when you look at the cases that make it through to the public statement or the regulatory action on the commission's website, they highlight a couple of customers who've spent a lot of money without many checks being done, and it seems fairly obvious that that wasn't right. But equally, slightly lower down the spectrum, where, you know, there's not an extremely obvious example of failings, but maybe people have just been spending a bit more than was affordable to them. In that area, I think things are still a bit vague, and a lot of companies have tried to put in place various forms of affordability checks, but the commission hadn't really told anyone exactly when you ought to be doing the check, and then when you do it, what you ought to be doing with the results. So, you know, they'll sort of say in retrospect, oh, well, obviously, once you found out that this person was a, you know, a school teacher, you shouldn't have been letting them spend £2,000 a month gambling. And yes, but equally, it wasn't necessarily obvious that you should have limited their play to, or that you should have stopped them at some point. So yeah, partly true. The commission is taking action in cases where perhaps operators should have known that they shouldn't let people gamble in this way, but equally they haven't been as clear, I think, as they could have been as to what operators should have been doing, particularly on the affordability checks.
Got it. And it sounds like the commission's got no experience of the under the table cash business secondary school teachers run, doing out of hours grinds. And
yeah.
I remember, it's a nasty little black economy that they've got going on there, and they dress it up in cardigans and they pretend they're better than everyone else. But
my son's last school report cost me a fortune.
Yeah.
And he's in primary school, so God knows what it's going to cost me at secondary school. But I think, one of his teachers might have an issue there. But I was also just thinking while you were talking, imagine Ray Winston and Danny Dyer and possibly Plan B turning up to get a license surrendered. Surrender your license or we're coming in.
No, you want like a Jason Statham type character just kind of walking in, punching everybody.
Statham.
Statham? Is that even it? Oh, I can't speak. What's my name? Right.
But yeah, that'd be good as well, because he's got a slightly South London growl.
And a six pack. It's amazing.
But yeah, you need to really find some people with Birmingham accents if you're there representing the Gambling Commission.
You're never going to be taken seriously with a Birmingham accent, let's be honest.
maybe that's where they're going wrong.
Oh, they're best. Sorry. I've just offended everybody at the Gambling Commission. It's a lovely accent. It's me celebrating diversity.
That's half my family is from Birmingham.
Explains a lot, John.
Well, that's the half we don't talk to.
So they all work at the Gambling Commission?
I've no idea. I don't know them. Mel, thank you so much for joining us again.
You're welcome.
And if you don't mind, we'll have you back, and we will think of other British actors that could be used to, make industry enforcement more fun.
But with the movie names itself, we can call it Enforcement Action. It's great. Ooh. It's a great movie. I can see it now.
I'm not sure who you're thinking is going to watch this, though.
Well, we would.
Yeah. But,
it's all about us, Mel. You've not realised that yet.
Thank you, Melanie.
Thanks. Bye for now.
We're now going to go to our next guest, who is Sarah Ramanauskas from Gambling Integrity. Sarah is a renowned, I'm going to say it, Sarah, on your behalf. I know you're too polite to say, but you're an absolutely renowned responsible gambling expert. Also a lovely person, and is currently deep in the wine country in France right now. So we're all incredibly jealous. Sarah, welcome. Thanks for taking time from your holiday to come and talk about this. I think that shows the level of your dedication.
Absolutely, Fenton. But don't forget, I have a wine tasting at the Vigneron just up the road in about an hour's time. So, we need to keep to time if I'm to make my tasting.
We're not going to keep you from that. We're humans.
We're on the clock, John. We're on the clock. We've got to bring our A game now. So as I sit here in a very rainy Amsterdam looking at the traffic. So Sarah, there's been a big announcements in the responsible gaming world in the UK with the new slogan, "Take time to think," replacing the old slogan, "When the fun stops, stop." Now, why do we have slogans? Why does it matter? And why have they changed?
Okay. So a slogan is important because it's something catchy that makes the general public kind of go, oh, yeah, I guess I need to do something about that. And really at the heart of everything I wanted to kind of discuss with with you guys today is this idea of public health messaging. How do you make the general public more aware that gambling can actually lead to fairly disastrous consequences? So how do you get that across, and how do you make people, as we used to say, behave in a more responsible way? At which point I always used to go, yeah, but gamblers don't want to be responsible, so that's not going to work, is it? Which is why we now have safer gambling. So over time, in the UK, that kind of messaging has developed. So we've had for really some years now, when the fun stop, and I will talk a bit about the research around that. And we've now got take time to think. So both of those are kind of catchy, hopefully, slogans, which the public, whether that's someone who gambles or someone who doesn't gamble, remembers and then does something about. And I guess that's, you know, where we're all coming from. It's like, well, yes, it's good that we've got a slogan, but does that actually make someone do something as a result of the slogan, if that makes sense? So yes, we need slogans because they're catching people remember them, but then you also need some actions behind those slogans. And I guess that's where we're looking for evidence to say, has this actually helped people or not?
Is there evidence? Is there, like, does any research go into this?
Okay, so, well, for when the fun stop, anecdotally, you know, if you talk to people in the treatment world, or if you talk to people with lived experience, and you said, what do you think of when the fun stop, they would all turn green and give long diatribes about how terrible it is and how you can't just stop. It's just, you can't do that. It's an addiction. There's no way you can just stop. So anecdotally, this original slogan, when the fun stop, was very much denigrated by pretty much everybody in the gambling addiction space. And in terms of research, the Senate group, who I don't know if you remember them, they were a kind of group that were supposed to be independent of the industry, but were kind of funded by the industry. They put that slogan out and then did some research. And their research showed things like 16% of everybody who had seen this slogan then kind of jokingly would sort of say to someone they knew, oh, you need to stop that gambling. Which again, in our view, isn't really all that helpful. So it was then followed up by some research from the London School of Tropical Medicine. Don't ask me why the London School of Tropical Medicine. But anyway, they obviously have some researchers who saw this and thought, oh, yes, that's definitely the sort of thing we need to research. Anyway, because it's public health. So they produced a long and quite technical paper that basically at the end of it said, what it doesn't do, it doesn't say why, right? So this is, if you like, the crux of this issue. So we had when the fun stop, and it's like, well, that, you know, that isn't really helping people who have a problem, a real addiction, to go get help. And we've now got take time to think. Is that going to make a difference? Is that actually going to be helpful? So talking to friends in the treatment area, what they've said is, look, this is a public health message, right? And if you look at all of the stuff coming out of the Gambling Commission or Gamble Aware or GamCare, they all now talk about public health. And everybody goes, yeah, public health. So everybody sort of says public health, and people go, yeah, public health. But what does that really mean? What that means is at the beginning of any kind of public health program, you need awareness. But you need awareness of what the health issue is. And what's missing from Take Time to Think is it doesn't tell you the consequences of not doing this. If that makes sense. So if you remember, I don't know if you remember when we introduced backseat seatbelts, and everybody went, why do we have to put our seatbelt on in the back? You know, what the government then did is it explained why. And I will always remember the ad of the son in the back seat who didn't have his seatbelt on. And what happened when they were in a crash was he basically, you know, was flung forward and squashed the person in the driving seat. That is the sort of public health message that people associate a public health campaign with. It says, if you don't do this, this is what happens.
Yeah.
Right. Whereas with take time to think, it just says, you know, take a break. It actually, one of the tweets actually said something like, take a break every time you bet, which makes no sense whatsoever to anybody who gambles. And it says, you know, take a break, put a deposit limit on, use these tools, but it doesn't say why. So in our view, you know, in the view of like the treatment world and the lived experience world, it's like, well, is this really going to work? Because it doesn't tell you what happens if you don't do this. And again, coming back to this issue of people go, well, I don't need those tools because, you know, I'm not going to be a gambling addict. I don't have a problem. Why would I use that? Hmm. That why is what we think is missing still.
Because this makes sense. Because like if you look at, say, cigarette packets and they've got these gruesome photos on the side, like it doesn't stop people from smoking, right? Or like we were talking to Keith White from the NCPG a couple of weeks ago about day traders with problem addictions. And, you know, there's a trend among, say, the Wall Street Bets kind of guys where they call it loss porn. So they're sharing their losses and they're actually getting status mm-hmm. for how much money they've lost. Mm-hmm. So I suppose, mm-hmm. and then your point of, well, when the fun stop for somebody with a problem, they can't stop. You'd apply that logic applies to take time to think, because if you've got a problem, you're not thinking. You're just thinking about your next bet, right? So is there an argument to say that, okay, this helps the majority, but then obviously the small percentage with problems, a slogan, they need more than a slogan, where the slogan is good for kind of general awareness, but it's not going to, it's a Band-Aid on a bit, much bigger problem.
Yes. I mean, talking to lived experience people about take time to think, their view is once you're at the point of kind of no return, once you're over that like invisible line where you are just desperate for the next bet and, you know, the opportunity to try and win back your mm-hmm. losses, you're not thinking rationally. And there's a whole load of research into cognitive distortions and the way in which gamblers bend the truth of the world to what they want to see in order to justify their next bet, or in order to justify dipping into their savings, or to justify borrowing their parents' savings, because in their view, they're just borrowing it. You know, they're going to give it back. It's going to be the next win. I've got a strategy. And if you're at that stage, then take time to think is useless. Yeah.
But then I suppose the counter argument to that would be, well, look, it's a slogan, it's to raise awareness, it's to help influence behavior, but we shouldn't put more, we shouldn't expect it to solve all problems. It's just a slogan. It's like, just do it for Nike isn't everything for, you know what I mean? It's kind of a...
Exactly. It's a start. And also, I think, in my view, it's a lot better than when the fun stop, because what I felt was happening with when the fun stop, because the Senate group came out and said, oh, everybody's aware of this. But the problem with that is that people who don't gamble were really aware of when the fun stop. And so if you don't gamble, you think you can just stop, right? In my view, what it was doing was it was potentially actually increasing stigma around gambling, around problem gambling, and making people who don't really understand the field and don't understand the addiction, making them think that if they knew someone with a gambling problem, well, it's just, oh, they just obviously don't have any willpower because you can just stop, right?
Got it. Okay.
So what So what we really want from messaging around around problem gambling, around gambling addiction or disordered gambling, is we want messaging, public health messaging, that's more like the work that's now being done around mental health. What we want to try and do is really reduce the stigma that's associated with gambling addiction, because 9 times out of 10, what prevents someone coming forward when they've got a gambling problem is the shame and the guilt and the stigma associated with that.
Mm. So what
so is, that's a name.
And that makes perfect sense, right? So what are they doing with the mental health public messaging then that's working so well that they can learn from?
I think, for example, it's okay to not be okay. And the way in which that is being used, particularly with men, is to put across a message that says, it's very simple, it's non-judgmental, and it's supportive as well. So it's okay to not be okay. It's then a sort of an opening to people to provide help, if you like.
Got it. And that makes a lot of sense. The new slogan is an improvement, but actually, it's okay to not be okay. It's such a simple slogan, yet actually really powerful, right? And you can, it makes sense. So is this already dead in the water in terms of, like, should they just stop and go for something else, or are we stuck with this now for the next?
We're probably stuck with it for the time being, but what I'm doing and what other people are doing is we're kind of looking at it and going, right, how can we best use this? So if we've got the slogan, which is take time to think, how do we extend that in any particular direction? So for example, if you're an operator and you're putting more information on your website, what needs to go around that slogan that will really help people understand why they should use those tools? So maybe there's work that the gambling operators themselves can do that says, take time to think, use a deposit limit, because if you don't use a deposit limit, you're likely to spend money that you don't have. I'm not terribly creative. I'm just sort of making something up as I go along here. But you can see what I'm getting at. What we want to do is say, right, well, we've got this. How can we make the best use of it? How can we extend it so that people really understand why that message is there?
Yeah, because I saw something really good shared by Odds Checker today on LinkedIn, where they did this benchmark of all the responsible gambling tools across all the major sports book in the UK. And it was kind of green ticks for everything that was legally required. So everybody had everything that was legally required. And then there was all the stuff that wasn't legally required, but was obviously really good for consumers. So things like profit and loss graphs. And there was a bunch of extra features. And then it got incredibly patchy. So I think you're right in terms of really walking people through the tools and making sure they're enabled by default and set up by default and done in the right way. John, go for it.
Well, when one of the issues with these things, I mean, slogans are obviously an incredibly powerful tool, and in Britain what we're seeing used by our incumbent government is sloganeering at its finest and its worst, and it's staggeringly effective. What repetition is staggeringly effective, but the problem with any campaign that has to find a problem group is getting it in front of that group at the right time. And so, in the interest of full disclosure, I edit Casino International magazine for the casino industry. I work freelance. I also do some work with Necton. I don't know if you're familiar with them.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. Yeah.
So I'm sure you know Michael's work.
Yeah.
And all the stuff he's co-published with the gentleman at Nottingham Trent. But it's interesting that this is take time to think, because as has been shown in research, cognitive dissonance is a very, very powerful tool in making people take that step back, take that second to just have a think, oh shit, what have I done? What am I doing? Mm-hmm. Do I really want to do this? Breaking them out of that rhythm of pressing a button or whatever. So I think the message is fine, but it's getting it in front of people at the right time, at that moment when they're making that decision. Because if it's just on the door of the bookies, well, okay, meh. it's just a bunch of words. It's getting the message in front of them and using a tool like Mentor, which does cognitive dissonance messaging, to bring it up at that point of problematic patterns emerging. You know, the technology is there for this to be potent.
I can see what you're saying, but again, you know, and I love the work that Necton does, but there's a lot of research that shows that people don't really see those messages when they're in the zone. And in fact, if you interrupt someone who does, and in fact, I think this is a piece of work that Michael's done, if you interrupt someone with a message, say they've been gambling on slots for an hour, and you pop up a message that says, did you realize you've been gambling on slots for an hour? And you make them take a break. If they have a gambling addiction, they actually gamble more after that break, because you've interrupted their play and they are even more desperate to try and win it back. So I think, you know, again, this is, we need to approach this from a public health perspective, which is, how do you get a general message out there when someone's not in the zone? So not, you know, not when they're going into the bookies, but, you know, just when they're at home doing something else, they're not in the gambling zone. They're not desperate to win. You know, they're not thinking just about gambling. They're thinking about their lives.
The equivalent of not going to the offie and buying a bottle of vodka, basically. It's having that time to think before you take that first destructive step.
Exactly. Exactly. You know, and when, you know, you're planning Christmas, for example, that's a really good time to get these messages out there. It's like, well, you'll need, you know, you're budgeting for the food, the booze, presents, you know, actually, do you want to dial down your gambling as part of that budget planning? See, I think you need to get people when they're thinking rationally about how they're going to spend their money, rather than when they're in the middle of a gambling zone, in the middle of a gambling binge, because they're just, it's not going to be helpful, in my view.
Fair. So you think that's better than, or a better way to approach it than removing the stigma of getting help for problem? So, because in my, like, I run ultramarathons, so I know a little bit about addictive personalities types, and I run because for lots of, it's cheaper than therapy. But is it better? So obviously, like, the right answer is we do both, right? But from an effective, is it like catching somebody before they take that first destructive step, is it really going to stop them? Or is it better to create the, look, it's not a stigma, it's okay, or it's okay to get help, and there's help and support and structure here too.
Yeah,
help. I know I'm using the word help a lot. I'm saying this badly, but I think you get the point.
Yeah, and unfortunately, I think you're right. It is sort of all of the above. So it's about making sure that if someone is in the early stages of learning about gambling, that they also learn about the tools, but they learn about why those tools are necessary. So they know that they know the risk that they're taking. So they understand, for example, that slots are more addictive than gambling on betting on, I don't know, tennis, for example. So there's a product difference. So they've got that information, but there's also the sort of everything that's going on in the background. It linked a lot of the time with mental health because of there's very strong links between gambling addiction and other mental health issues. So that work is going on in the background to create an environment where if someone does think, hang on, no, this is, I need to talk to someone about this. This is getting out of hand, that they feel they can admit it to someone else. Because that's usually the first step is, you know, I need to talk to someone. And often what we find is the customer service staff at the gambling operators are the only people who know about your gambling and the extent of your gambling. So again, you know, time for the operators to say, well, if you've got this new slogan, take time to think, how do we incorporate that better into the interventions that we have with people that we think are gambling in a risky way? And how do we encourage them to take that step to make sure that they get help?
So I like this because as a marketing nerd at heart, like if this was a brand promise, so I don't know, fun, fair, friendly, the home of poker, whatever your slogan is, your brand team would sit there and say, right, how can we deliver on this promise through everything that we do?
Exactly.
So every email template, every tweet, every ad, every whatever. So if the industry is taking this on as a slogan, like your point is, how are you integrating this into everything that you do to back it up?
Mm-hmm.
I love it. I think that's
make Yeah, to make it real for your customers as well, because you know they've all got a view of what the brand means. You know, your brand means to them, and how much they trust your brand, and therefore, how do you put a your own kind of spin on this that will really break through that kind of wallpaper? Because I know when the fun stop just became this sort of yellow wallpaper that you know nobody took any notice of. So I think we've got this opportunity with a new slogan and a new set of ideas to say, right, how do we really, in marketing terms, land this with people and make them understand why are we telling you this? Why do you need to do this? This is what we're telling you, but why?
You touched on something there that I keep meaning to have this conversation with Michael at Necton, but we could have it now, and you can shoot me down as an idiot, which is fine because you're the expert.
It happens every week. Don't worry about it.
So the responsibility for dealing with problem gambling always falls at the gambling industry's feet. And most people would say, well, that's fair enough, they're the problem. But I think it's very fair to say that more often than not, considerably more often than not, gambling is a symptom of another problem. It's...
Mm-hmm. I quite agree.
While there is... Obviously, there is responsibility within the industry and there is the technology within the industry existing to detect problem play to, you know, and don't even get me started on account managers. And if account managers are listening, it's nothing personal, but while you're commission based, it's all going to stay fucked. Anyway, what I'm getting at is the gambling industry is never, ever, ever going to be able to do this on its own. It mm-hmm. needs kind of interagency work. So mm-hmm. so GamStop, GamCare, all of those, they're never going to be able to do it all on their own. And I was speaking to Jane Fahey from Gordon Moody about their work, which is tremendous. But she's coming on next week, actually. And it was a major eye-opener for me. Because they're doing this residential gambling course for women, and hearing from her what some of the main drivers are for women in problem gambling, because it can be a distraction, an escape. The industry can never tackle that on its own because we can't tackle substance abuse, we can't tackle domestic abuse, but it's got to be part of a much larger solution. So possibly that can come into the public health angle.
So if you look at the work that's being done, for example, by Beaker Counselling Trust in the Northwest or ARA in Wales in the Southwest, that is exactly what they do. They have a multi-agency approach, and it is absolutely key that this now becomes the standard for someone who presents with a gambling addiction. So it's got to be really joined up across, you know, social services, mental health, even things like chronic pain, for example, can be very closely linked with gambling, because the gambling helps takes your mind away from the pain. So there's always lots of different needs that need to be joined up. And part of the reason I think that this hasn't been done in the past is because our National Health Service generally works in silos. So what we're seeing is that gambling addiction now more and more, hopefully, is just becoming part of this joined up process across lots of different areas of social care, mental health care, GP services, homelessness, etc. So that if you are treated as an individual, and that's really, really important. And I completely agree with you. I was doing some work in the States and talking to various stakeholders of the lottery that I was working for. And there was one guy who was a gambling treatment counselor, and he'd been a treatment counselor in gambling for about 6 or 7 years. And he'd seen hundreds of people in that time. And he said, in all that time, all those hundreds of people, there was only one guy whose problem was gambling. Everybody else had all sorts of other problems that you needed to treat holistically. Yeah, and that's a great public health challenge. So yes, I agree. The industry is not going to solve gambling addiction, but what it can do is it can help in whatever way join up the dots. And this is why, you know, Fintan will know this, when I'm working with affiliates or when I'm working with the operators and I look at their safer gambling pages, I'm like, don't just put GamCare on there. Think about what else your customers might want if they're in shtuck. You know, do they need debt help? Do they need mental health help? You know, do they need bereavement services? Whatever it is, but just, you know, signpost more help in more ways to give this joined up picture, as you're saying.
Yeah, I think it's an awful lot of people, you know, highlight the mental health aspect of problem gambling, but actually you really hit on something there, because like bereavement, I mean, it generally is such a seismic event. And I haven't touched a drink in just over 4 years now. And while I would not be described as an alcoholic, I was a very contented and dedicated drinker. And it was for health reasons that I stopped, but I lost both my parents last year, and I've never been so tempted to not just have a drink. I knew where I'd go with it. It wasn't just going to be having a drink. I was thinking maybe I could just take a month out from my life and get absolutely fucked up.
Wow.
And I thought, maybe I won't. What I did was I took time
so
to
glad
think.
You didn't. There you go. But you see,
it's preemptive.
With that, you knew what the likely risks were of drinking that much. So yes, you took time to think, but that's because there was the other side to that message, which was, if I do this, this is what's going to happen to me, and that would not be good. Mm.
We've opened a can of worms here, and you've got to go to a wine tasting in a bit. Talking of drink.
It'll be very small amounts.
You'll be spitting it out after. I'm excited that we've got Jane on next week, because I think Gordon Moody are doing some really, really interesting work. And the interagency approach. I'm delighted to hear that it's being done in some areas, but it's mildly disappointing that it's not that agencies are having to do it by themselves rather than being led by government to do it, because there's no question that that's going to be way more effective.
Mm-hmm. Well, yes, but then we need an effective government, which is a whole other podcast.
Good luck with that. But interestingly, you just did something that the government has done really effectively. If you go back to before the last election in the UK, the NHS was always referred to as the NHS. And every single Tory politician has, for the last several years, been referring to it as our NHS, every single one. And every time you see somebody refer to the NHS on TV now, they refer to it as our NHS, not the NHS. And it's very, very simple, but very, very subtle and very, very sly. You will never see a serving government minister now refer to it as anything other than our NHS. Repetition, sloganeering, branding. They've done it using the most basic branding tools. And it's unbelievably effective. So why can't we do that effectively in a public health scenario? I don't know. Sorry, I totally went off on a bunch of tangents there.
That's okay. I think that's a perfect place to stop. Sarah, you've got a wine tasting. Thank you so much. You've been an absolute pleasure and a wealth of knowledge. And I'm loving the treat it like if it was a brand campaign, how would you integrate it into your business? Mm-hmm. And I think that's for me, that's just such a simple way to look at it, because actually then it'll be quite easy to see how seriously brands are treating this. And I think that's and then the public health aspect of this as well, in terms of it's a joined up approach. And I think that opens up a lot more, you know, for example, where does the industry donations go to? So should it just automatically be gambling addiction services? And, you know, obviously they need funding, but there could be maybe some more effective spend if the donations were joined up with other charities that work closely with them and other services. So this is phenomenal. Thank you. We'd love to have you back at some point in the future, and enjoy the rest of your holiday.
Yeah,
I will do so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Sarah.
Thank you, guys. Thank you so much for the invite.